Well, the book is really about the history of the Middle East, but it's a history written, I hope, in a rather modern way. In other words, it's not chronological. It begins, for example, with me interviewing Osama bin Laden in his mountain camp in Afghanistan. It goes back to my eyewitness account of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, in which, of course, bin Laden was involved in fighting the Russians on our behalf. It goes through the Iran-Iraq War, and then goes right back to the First World War, when my father, who was much older than my mother, was a soldier. And it's the story of how he refused to execute an Australian soldier who was accused of murdering a British military policeman in Paris. And in some ways the book is about refusal, refusal to obey orders, refusal to accept the narrative of events laid down by our governments and our military people, especially when they're going to invade other people's countries. It's a big book, 1,300 pages. It's actually called The Great War for Civilization, because when my father died, aged 93 in 1992, I inherited his campaign medals, and on the back of his 1914-18 war medal, it is written, The Great War for Civilization. And because in the 17 months that followed that war, the victors, Britain and France, carved the frontiers of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East, I decided, as well as having actually spent my life reporting Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East, I decided to adopt, if somewhat ironically, the message on his medal, although his medal is actually running down the spine. You can see his medal ribbon and the medal on the spine of the book. And so the book is really about how you can't switch off history, but also how it's necessary to refuse to accept what we're told at face value, and to try somehow to say, hold on a second, we people have got to govern history, not leaders, not people who are trying to manipulate us. But it's a big book. It deals with the Armenian genocide, the Algerian war, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's three whole big chapters on that. And the book, in fact, ends. It goes at the very end. It becomes chronological. The Afghan, the September 11th, 2001, the bombardment of Afghanistan, and then the folly of our invasion of Iraq, my eyewitness account of it. And the book ends with the Americans deep in the wilderness of occupation and the collapse of our rule in Iraq.
Yep. When I spoke to you last year in Baghdad, you spoke about how the about our inability to learn from history, and you mentioned the invasion, obviously, by the British, or the occupation of Iraq, the siege of Najaf and the surrounding Fallujah.
That's right.
Shelling Fallujah, I think, issuing proclamations, issuing laws.
Yep.
Installing a puppet monarchy. I mean, is there any sign that we're, now around about now, we might be sort of getting the message? Are we learning from history?
No, I mean, the problem is that we don't read history. If we read it, we don't remember it. I mean, it's not just the British who arrived here in 1917 with the same message the Americans tried to give. We've come to liberate you. Napoleon landed his soldiers and his fleet in Egypt, claiming he was coming to liberate the people of Cairo from the Ottoman pashas. Various Venetian fleets arrived in the Middle East claiming they were going to liberate people. Remember that the very first crusade was carried out on the basis that the crusaders were going to go and liberate the Christians of the Middle East who were under pressure supposedly from the Muslims. We've always been arriving in the Middle East with our guns and our tanks and our horses and our infantry and our cavalry and our Apache helicopters and our Bradley armored vehicles, announcing that we're coming to liberate the people. And we offer them democracy, but I think the people of the Middle East probably want freedom from us.
Well, of course, Napoleon famously camped for a while in a little place called Gaza, and obviously the Israelis have just completed their withdrawal. I mean, is there any hope for areas in the Middle East, or is it all just a big game?
I don't think so. I mean, Gaza is a rubbish tip. It's a ghetto.
Which it's like for being...
Look, Sharon has withdrawn the settlements from Gaza, has closed them down. Well, that's fine. But he continues to enlarge the settlements in the West Bank, and the West Bank is the only place where there can be a viable Palestinian state. So as one hope is raised over Gaza, the major hope, the major hope in the West Bank is basically being switched off. You cannot hope to have a serious Palestinian state in the West Bank if you're going to have these huge Jewish settlements built on Arab land for Jews and Jews only, which is what colonization is about. But Bush has already said, George W. Bush has already said, there are facts on the ground, which effectively gets rid of UN Security Council Resolution 242, which says that there must be an Israeli withdrawal from land occupied in 1967 in return for security and recognition for all states in the area, including Israel. So I don't see how you deal with the West Bank problem. Remember that the settlers who are religious know that the historic Israel, the Israelite Israel of the Bible, is the West Bank, not the coastal plain of Tel Aviv and Haifa, which is in many cases occupied by the Philistines. So the West Bank is of critical importance for settlers. And I don't see how Sharon is going to conceivably withdraw those settlements or close them down. And only if he does that, and if at least part of Jerusalem can be a Palestinian capital, the east part perhaps, and the west part be the capital of Israel, I don't see how there can be peace there. I don't see any real great hope around the Middle East. There's plenty of things we can claim are hopeful, but we are doing so fraudulently.
The fact that at the same time as he's removing roughly 8,500 settlers from Gaza, there's the approximate equivalent of two Gazas going into the West Bank every year.
Yes, that is the problem. You put it very well. And as long as that happens, no one can assume that Sharon really wants a viable Palestinian state. And the Palestinians, of course, will say, they've taken more of our land. How can we be expected to make peace? And this is the continual and ironic story of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Both sides claim they want peace, and one side continues to take the land of the other, and the other continues to attack the other for doing so.
So the so-called war on terror, the current sort of manifestation, if you like, of our of the West's meddling in the Middle East, I mean, the Bush administration says it's going well. They say that 50 million people have been liberated in Afghanistan, Iraq, that Libya has turned away from weapons of mass destruction because of pressure, and democracy
well,
is on the march in Lebanon. I mean, what do you
think? Yes, yeah, sure. Well, number one, I don't think Libya really had serious weapons of mass destruction. I think that was a con to make us believe that, you know, Iraq could have good results. Iraq has not been liberated in any true sense. It's been turned over to the forces of anarchy. With the exception of Kurdistan, the entire country of Iraq is now out of control of central government or the Americans or the British. And when you go there, you realize it, that people are in agony over the lack of security, the suicide bombers, the lack of electricity, there's no safety for their children at school, there's endless criminal kidnappings across the whole state of Iraq, except, as I say, for Kurdistan. People are not sitting at home discussing constitutional referendum. They're just sitting at home wondering how they can survive. We can continue to play the drum of success, but on the ground, if you go there, it's disaster. I mean, Iraq is a hell disaster. As for Lebanon, we await the UN Commission of Inquiry into who killed the former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, and I'm sure they'll point the finger at Syria, but the fact of the matter is that Lebanon continues to be a violent place. A journalist whom I knew quite well, May Shidiak, was attacked the other day with a bomb. She lost an arm and a leg. We had only a few weeks before another prominent Lebanese journalist murdered, and indeed the men and women who formed the so-called revolution, it was never called a Cedar Revolution in Lebanon, of course, that was a State Department spokesman that gave it that name, the so-called, you know, move to democracy is now falling to pieces, with indeed one of the most prominent Christian leaders allying himself to pro-Syrian members of parliament.